I'm Sir Dave King. I have been a research scientist in the university sphere for most of my career, and then 20 years ago I moved into the British government as chief scientific advisor to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown over an eight-year period. And subsequently I moved into the Foreign Office to head up our climate negotiations. We've known since the 19th century that if we burn fossil fuels, we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. We need carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to get a nice warm temperature that we typically have, but you add more, it's like putting another duvet on your bed. You get hotter, and that's what we're doing by burning fossil fuels and by removing forests, because forests take carbon dioxide out of the air. And this was predicted back in the 19th century. A lot of people said, well, we can never use that much fossil fuel at that time. But we have reached the level that the worst predictions that were being made in the 19th century were talking about. So as we move forward, the real risks are that we're only about 1 to 1.5 degrees, less than 1.5, above the pre-industrial level today. Now, that doesn't sound like an awful lot. But the results of this, you must have all heard of the fires in Australia, the fires in California, the fires in Portugal and Spain. All of these are events which are much more likely with climate change that has been happening. And the worst of all is that gradually we've been losing ice over the Arctic Sea. And sitting here in Honolulu, you may think that's a long way away. But the Arctic Sea has always been covered with ice, going way back. And now, during the Arctic summer, half of that sea is exposed to sunlight. The sea absorbs sunlight, and the whole Arctic Circle region is now heating up at much, much faster than the rest of the planet, about 2.5 times faster. Why is that a problem? Simply because Greenland is sitting there adjacent to the Arctic Sea, and Greenland ice is beginning to melt faster and faster. So why is it melting? Because it's warmer. And if all of Greenland ice melts, the whole planet will see a sea level rise of about 7 meters. Right? We would not be sitting here with a sea level rise of anything like that amount. So we are faced today with challenges that we're putting in place that will be very real challenges for all of us in 30 to 50 years' time.
Now, you were in a similar position at another point in your career, and you got people in government to realize that and act on it.
Yes. So the British government decided very early on by unanimous agreement in the Houses of Parliament to act on climate change.
How did they do that?
What drove that was my Flood and Coastal Defences report.
They believed the information in your report?
Why would anyone question what the chief scientific advisor is saying? Of course they believed it.
I'm trying to figure out what the disjunct is.
What the disjunct is in other parts of the world, perhaps, but in Britain and in Europe, we've been acting on this for a long time. Britain began the Industrial Revolution. We have fired up our entire economy using coal. Last year, we had 6 weeks without burning any coal in Britain to produce electricity. How did we do that? We've had governments, one after the other, of different colors, Labour, Conservative, coalition governments, and all of them have been set on a program agreed by all parties back in 2008 to reduce our emissions on the one hand, and we have a program which is to reduce all of our emissions, not just from electricity, but from road and everything, to net zero by 2050, and we've got to do this.
Wait, now, is Britain in conformity with the Paris Accord at this point?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
You sound surprised. But the whole of Europe is in conforming with the Paris Agreement. We were the ones pushing for the Paris Agreement Why wouldn't we conform?
Well, I thought that it was still aspirational for the signatories even. You know?
No. Each country was asked to produce a promise on reducing emissions.
Correct. Yeah,
each and every 197 nations signed up to that. The United States has backed away from that and is not following their own promise. But most of the countries of the world are following that.
Okay, I thought I had someone here recently now, who said that France isn't even following the Paris Accords.
That's some also misinformation.
Okay, thank
France
you.
Is certainly following it. Mm-hmm. Germany has fallen back. And the reason Germany fell back was because of the nuclear disaster in Fukushima. And they shut down their nuclear plants after that. And I believe this was very unwise because Fukushima was the result of a tsunami hitting the coastline of Japan. Large number of people lost their lives. Not one person has lost their life from that accident of the nuclear plant. Nuclear plant was flooded. But thousands of people lost their lives from the tsunami. Now, in Germany, there was a kind of panic. We've got all these nuclear power stations, and they shut them down, and they had to go back to coal.
Oh, gosh. Okay. So one of the major benefits of having such clear government policy as you've enjoyed in Britain would be that you can encourage businesses, corporations, to pursue research and development in the area that you desire, right? Have you been encouraging the type of investment that we need to see in these technologies that are going to save us?
Yes, but not only businesses, also public money, right? So let me tell you about something called Mission Innovation, which was originally my idea. And what we did was go around to every country and say, would you like to join Mission Innovation, which is a program aimed at spending $30 billion a year of public money on research and development to find all the technologies we need in the post-fossil fuel era. The money being spent this year, 2020, is $22 billion. We were meant to have got to $30 billion by this year. There's only one country that's backed away from its promise, and that's the United States. But $22 billion a year of public money to find all these technologies is a pretty good effort. And so I believe that we're going to produce the technologies, that we are producing them, and that we can speed up the transition for deep and rapid emissions reduction, which is the program we've got to be on. But what I'm now saying, that is not enough. That is not enough because we're already too far into the fossil fuel era. We've put too much into the atmosphere, and we need to take it out of the atmosphere. Now, we're putting it in at close on 40 billion tons a year, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The program of work I've engaged in, and the University of Hawaii is now engaged in as well, is to see how we can pull out 30 to 40 billion tons a year from the atmosphere, so that we can sequester it, put it away safely and out of the atmosphere to bring global temperatures back down to a safe level. This is a risk management exercise for the whole planet.
What are some possible technologies along that line?
One reason why Hawaii is a great place to do this is because we have 72% of the ocean's surface is ocean. Sorry, of the Earth's surface is ocean. And here in Hawaii, we've got terrific experts on oceanography, on the state of the oceans, on climate change. And so these are the people I've been talking to all week. We're discussing how do we use the oceans to bring greenhouse gases down out of the atmosphere. And one possibility is to use a natural process. So when the wind blows over the Sahara Desert, it picks up a dust storm. And the dust is dust particles from the desert. And the dust particles from the desert are yellow-red, They are that color because they contain iron. And iron is a missing nutrient in the sea. So when these dust storms blow over the Atlantic, for example, and then the wind dies down, the dust particles pepper the surface of the water with these dust particles. And within a month, that area, maybe 10,000, maybe 100,000 square kilometers, is green. Suddenly, we've grown an ocean forest. And within that forest, you develop very quickly fish. Female fish lay about 100,000 eggs each a year. The sea is full of female eggs. Right? Fish larvae hatch from the eggs. Most of them die because there's no food. But where there's a green area, there's plankton. And plankton is the foodstuff of the fish larvae. The fish all hatch. You get billions and billions of fish. Large fish come in. Whales come in. And so you have a living forest in the sea. Now, this only lasts a year or two. What we're looking at is, can we mimic this process? It takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. The question is, can we fix the carbon dioxide permanently so it doesn't go back into the atmosphere? But we do know that we can restock the ocean with fish in this way. So this is called iron fertilization of the ocean.
How does it decrease carbon dioxide in the air?
Right, that's a very good question. If you have green matter, like trees, it's taking carbon dioxide out of the air in sunlight. Green matter is chlorophyll-based, and that is how trees grow. That's how this whole patch grows, and this is where the plankton comes from. So it's all driven by taking carbon dioxide out of the air and out of the seawater. Iron is the catalyst. You don't even need a lot of iron, a relatively small amount of iron, but it's a missing nutrient in the sea. Every other nutrient is there. So once you've added the catalyst, away it goes, and you don't need any more iron for another year in that area.
Gee, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Now, this is only one of the ideas that's being looked at. So in this business of looking at climate repair, the new movement is greenhouse gas entrapment, capturing greenhouse gases, removing them from the atmosphere in a way that they don't go back into the atmosphere. When we were burning fossil fuels, we were doing just the opposite. And we need to take the product of burning the fossil fuels back out of the air.
Is that what geoengineering is?
So geoengineering, in my view, is something called solar radiation management. This was put forward by Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen. And what Paul said was, if we were to put sulfate particles up in the stratosphere, where all these satellites are, if we were to put sulfate particles up there, they will reflect sunlight away from the Earth, and therefore the Earth will be cooled down. So that's solar radiation management. There are other mechanisms of solar radiation management, but this is the one that's been discussed in more detail. It would be relatively easy to put some sulfate particles up there, but to get enough to make a difference, you'd need tons of sulfate particles. So it's not just a matter of one rocket in space doing it. But nevertheless, a lot of modeling has been done on that. And the modeling shows that changing the Earth's temperature by reflecting sunlight away produces results that don't always look good. So, for example, in some of the models we see the monsoon collapsing in India. And, of course, the whole Indian agricultural economy depends on the monsoon. So I'm one of many people who are saying that form of geoengineering needs to be put on the back burner. We shouldn't be using it. We can experiment and see if we can make it work, but we should not be doing it at scale. We shouldn't scale it up, because there might be some really terrible effects. But the second potential bad effect would be that we once again create the ozone hole, which was a big discussion some years ago. And basically, the ozone in the stratosphere is a good molecule to have up there because it captures the very energetic radiation, which if a human being is exposed to that, we end up with cancer. So it's not good for us to lose ozone from the stratosphere.
So geoengineering, that word, though, refers to pretty much to that one technique.
That's the word I'm only using for that technique.
Okay. There are not other forms of geoengineering that commonly refer to
Well, all
to
the
that.
Others I'm referring to as climate repair or greenhouse gas removal.
Greenhouse gas removal
is very different from reflecting sunlight away.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any sort of almost like, well, I mean, this geoengineering, is it, do you see any sort of, do you see it sort of shaping up as a fallback or as like a least expensive option or a more likely option because it's cheaper or that kind of thing?
I think we would have to be in a desperate situation to use aerosol spraying into the stratosphere because the outcome could well be very negative, right? So I think it needs to be there as a possible fallback, but I very much hope we can be sensible enough to put in place the other measures, particularly removing greenhouse gases, so we get greenhouse gases back towards the level they were at before the Industrial Revolution, before we started burning all these fossil fuels.
Whoa, you're shooting for way back.
Yeah. Shooting for way back.
But haven't mentioned any other ideas, though, for capturing carbon and re-socking it away somewhere.
Right. There many different technologies have been discussed. But, for example, reforestation, afforestation. We have to stop all deforestation because trees take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, convert the carbon into woody matter. And then what do we do with woody matter if we have managed forests? If you want to make money out of the forests, some areas we can have managed forests. What about putting up all our buildings using wood? And there are tall buildings, 10, 12 stories high, going up entirely made of wood. And these buildings have very real advantages. But one of them is you're stabilizing the carbon that is being captured in the tree.
Yeah. You know, with our climate crisis emergency happening, Chip was in that just a few months ago saying, well, we need to plant more trees. And it looks like such a long-term solution to an emergency-style situation, you know.
Well, it takes about 20 years typically for a tree to grow to the size where it is operating as a means of capturing significant carbon dioxide. I think much more important is the issue of what kind of trees do you plant? You can't just plant any trees. And given that climate change is happening, we have to make sure that even in a changing climate, these are the right trees for that area. So it's not an easy business. We have to do it very carefully.
Any other ideas out there?
People in California in particular, but also elsewhere, are discussing and carrying out direct air capture experiments where you simply pump air through a system where the carbon dioxide is captured out of the air. And then what do you do with the carbon dioxide? You can either transform the carbon dioxide, for example, into a fuel, and then you burn the fuel. The carbon dioxide goes back into the atmosphere, so it's a zero carbon dioxide potential technology, or you bury it. Now, if you bury the carbon dioxide, that uses a lot of energy. So what I'm saying is I'm not terribly enthusiastic about direct air capture. But what I am saying is we need all of the above and more.
Mm-hmm. I see. You know, when you say carbon dioxide capture, I guess it could be in any form. It's not like it's a gas that you're trying to press down into a liquid. I mean, carbon, it could, what form is it in? It's just,
it's a gas.
It's a gas.
It's a gas. And you can press it down to the bottom of the ocean, and it will be in a form that is no longer gaseous.
Mm-hmm. It'll scrunch, it'll be compressed.
I like it, yes.
I know. Well, I don't know.
Compressed into liquid or solid form, and it's then going to be stable at very deep places in the ocean, 5,000-6,000 meters down. You don't have to go far from Hawaii to get that sort of level to the bottom of the sea.
Oh, I mean.
You don't look too happy, and the reason is quite rightly the energy required to pump it down there. Now, you can make it more and more efficient. What we've got to remember, even if these things cost money, the cost of doing this is going to be less of a damage to our economies than the impact of climate change itself. The cities of the world that are sitting on coastlines, and you can mention whichever one you like, whether it's New York or London or
Honolulu,
these cities are all at risk going forward in time from rising sea levels and storms at sea. What we're actually talking about is saving a future for humanity. It's no less than that. And what we do over the next 10 years, what we begin to do, what we continue doing, what we do afresh on this problem is going to determine the future of humanity for the next 10,000 years. This is a critical time for us. You're speechless.
Well, I'm an American. I'm wondering if things are looking dim, a little dim for you folks there.
You mean when I'm in the United States? Well, I'm in Honolulu. We've got all these wonderful guys around here who care about it just as much as we do over in the UK and Europe, who care about it just as much as everyone does in most of the rest of the world.
I mean, so I'm kind of getting that this is how it's going to roll out. You're spearheading this effort to look for really world-changing technologies, and we're going to get information about this one's really great. I mean, you're going to throw your resources behind maybe two or three technologies you really think are going to work for us. We're going to have to try all of them, and then we're going to have to try to get people to buy into that. And
people will buy into it when they understand the alternatives.
How? I just don't. Maybe we don't understand the alternatives. I think maybe we haven't painted the picture of the alternative enough.
Do you know that there is really only one part of the world where there are climate skeptics, and that's the United States? You asked me earlier on, why would they believe your report on flood and coastal defenses? And my answer is, I'm a scientist, and it was heavily based in very good science. And here in the United States, there seems to be a lack of belief in what science is, and that you can just, anybody can question it. And I'm astounded. If we look at our civilization, look at the technology around us as I'm talking to you, where did that come from, and how on earth did we manage to get a plane to fly such a heavy object, fly in the air? How did we manage to deliver all of the things that we live with all the time? It's because scientists understand more and more about how these things work. You go into hospital for an operation. Why do you trust the doctors? You trust them because their work is based on the best possible science.
Now, right now, I mean, what was the name of the project? I'm sorry, Dave, you were saying the name of the, it's called Mission...
Mission Innovation.
Mission Innovation. What do you do with that now? Are you still working on that project?
Yes. So this was a project I initiated when I was working within the British government. And as I say, spending $22 billion a year this year. And it is looking at finding, for example, how do we provide heat for cold countries? In Britain, it's quite cold in the winter. In all the homes and buildings, how do we provide heat? At the moment, we're burning gas. Gas is a fossil fuel. It produces carbon dioxide. So how do we heat buildings without using any fossil fuel? That's one of the big projects. How do we fly from Honolulu to mainland, either way, to mainland California or Japan or wherever? How do we do this without burning any fossil fuels? There's some wonderful new technologies emerging. People are all saying, oh, we won't be able to fly without burning fossil fuels. And I say, nonsense. These technologies are being developed. Look at what's happening under Mission Innovation.
Are you feeling optimistic?
I'm feeling optimistic that Mission Innovation is rolling out the technologies we need. And amongst them, energy storage. If you go to renewable energy sources, which are wonderfully cheap, cheaper than any other form of energy to install new, these technologies, Britain has offshore wind in abundance. That's our most common form of creating electricity. If you take all of these technologies, we need energy storage, because there are times when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine at night. So what we have to have is energy storage. Lithium-ion batteries are doing a great job, but they're far too expensive to run storage for a national grid, for example. So new energy storage technologies are being developed. All of these, each one of these technologies is not going to be taken into the marketplace by the university people working on them. It's going to be taken into the marketplace by entrepreneurs and business people. Each one of them is a wealth creation opportunity. And what I've been saying for some years is there hasn't been such a wealth creation opportunity as the move away from fossil fuels since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Are there people eager to jump on board, or what? Are there investors eager to get into this sector?
Yes. Well, Bill Gates immediately understood what this was all about, created something called Breakthrough Energy Coalition, and he put down $1 billion of his private money to invest in the best technologies emerging from Mission Innovation. He also had signatories from 29 other very wealthy people from around the world to form Breakthrough Energy Coalition. So the answer is yes, because it is such a wealth creation opportunity. The biggest sector in the world is the energy sector.
I mean, are the best minds working on this now then, Dave, would you say?
I would say we've got some really brilliant people working on it. Absolutely.
Huh. This could be solved?
It is being solved. As we sit and talk, these new technologies are rolling out. It is being solved. And I have no doubt it can be. I've only got to look at my own country, Britain. You know, we're moving away from all these fossil fuel technologies. So the answer is yes, it can be done. Now, there's another question. Can it be done quickly enough? And I'm now saying we've let these fossil fuel industries run for too long. We've emitted too much greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. So not only do we have to move away from that, we also now have to recapture the excess of greenhouse gases we put in there. And there we haven't got the technologies rolled out yet. So what we need is a big new program to fund. And if you ask me how much do I need or does the world need in this program, I would say $50 to $60 billion a year to fund the mechanisms we need to put in place for climate repair, to pull greenhouse gases down from the atmosphere, but also to refreeze the poles. We have no choice. We have to refreeze the poles unless we don't mind losing all of our coastal cities.
Thank you so much. It's been fascinating talking with you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it very much too.
Thank you. Wow.